Down for a quorum.
Yeah, are you ready?
Why isn't one?
The House Committee on Revenue for March 5th, 2015 will come to order. Thank you, colleagues, for agreeing to start a few minutes late. Are you here on the first bill?
Yes.
All right, we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2858. Day?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. To know where in the formula revenue we're talking about, let's go over transportation grant just a little bit. So this is the first chart that we always start with. So we're looking at this lowest part where we're talking about general purpose grant and transportation grant. So this is the part we're talking about, transportation grant. Oops, it's blocking. All right, so that's the lowest part. So how does it work? First, approved transportation cost. It's the cost in providing transportation to elementary students living at least 1 mile from school, secondary students living at least 1.5 miles from school, certain students for health or safety reasons, certain preschool children with disabilities, students requiring room and board payment in lieu of transportation, students going between school facilities, and students on school-sponsored field trips. So distribution of transportation grant. It is 70% to 90% of approved transportation costs. School districts are ranked each fiscal year by approved transportation costs per ADM from the highest to the lowest. And so we have the chart, highest 10% gets 90% reimbursed, next highest 10%, 80%, and the remaining 80% of the school districts will get 70% reimbursed. So what this bill, House Bill 2858 does is this. Oh, let me give you a little background information first. So ORS 327.043 states that Oregon State Board of Education may waive the requirement to provide transportation for secondary school students residing more than 1.5 miles from school. Currently, two school districts, the Portland School District and the Eugene School District, have the waiver. These school districts have presented plans to the board for providing suitable and sufficient alternate modes of transporting students as required, and have the approval to use transit pass as alternate mode. So this measure, House Bill 2858, includes transit pass costs as approved transportation costs for purposes of the state school fund distribution. If a school district has received an approval by the Oregon State Board of Education to use transit passes for transportation. Now, the bill as is written includes the bus passes passed out to students, not only to the students residing more than 1.5 miles from school, but also to the students that reside within 1.5 miles from school. So this measure covers all the bus passes distributed to the students who are living within 1.5 miles from school and also outside 1.5 mile boundary. So it covers both students. I mean, the bus passes passed out to all the students within the district.
And could you describe for us where the money comes from if this bill passes? What's the pot of money from which this fund comes?
So yes, Chair. So if the bill is a becomes a law, then the part this the money comes from the transportation grant. So it's going to be part of approved transportation costs.
And for old members who don't remember, and for new members, would you describe where the transportation grant comes from?
So so the first there is a total formula revenue. Decided by the state school fund and local revenue. So you take out the carve-outs and set asides. It becomes the total revenue available, formula revenue available to school districts and ESDs. From there, you have 95.5% school district share and 4.5 education service district share. So from school district share, you take out high cost disabilities grant, facility grant, and school district share of quality teaching network, and the rest becomes formula revenue available for distribution to school districts. Now, basically, this is about general purpose grant and the transportation grant. So according to the ODE estimate, 15-16, we're estimating about $200 million for transportation grant. So if this bill becomes a law, then this bus cost, a bus pass cost, becomes part of approved transportation cost.
All right, so let me see if I, let me read it back to you and see if you, if I understand it correctly. The covered transportation costs for these two school districts would be 70%. And what I, what I think I understand from that is that they will calculate what their actual costs are, multiply by 0.7, and that's the amount of the transportation grant for those two districts.
Yes,
is that right?
Yes.
And it comes out of the revenue available for distribution before the calculation of ADMW.
This formula revenue available for distribution to school districts,
yes,
actually is based on ADMW and teacher experience. Now, transportation cost, transportation grant is calculated differently.
Right. I understand that. And the question is, where is it calculated? Does it come out before you calculate the ADMW, or does it come out in some other way?
You're talking about transportation grant?
Transportation grant.
Okay.
That's the topic subject of this bill.
Yes.
Right.
Transportation grant, actually, what it is the school districts would estimate their transportation cost and check with ODE, then rank each fiscal year the approved transportation costs per ADM, not ADMW.
Per ADM, right.
From the highest and to the lowest.
Right. And then calculate by that 90, 80, and 70 thing that you told us earlier.
Yes, sir.
Right.
So so then
and
the
that comes, does that then come off before you calculate the education ADMW or after?
So transportation grant is actually calculated before we apply, okay, if that's your question, yes.
That's what I'm after, right. I'm trying to understand how that works. So we've taken away all those special carve-outs.
Yes, sir.
Then after the special carve-outs, we calculate the transportation grant.
Yeah.
And then after that, whatever's left, which hopefully is a large amount, is divided up based on ADMW.
Yes, sir.
And then, of course, we have a whole bunch of other calculations in that number, but that's not the subject of our conversation today.
Yes.
Any other questions for staff? Please, Representative Davis.
So going back to the equation on the second page, I think my confusion comes for there's an equals formula revenue available for distribution to school districts, but shouldn't we add another? It's not technically, I suppose, a carve-out because it's based on ADM, but it does reduce ADMW distributions for all districts. Shouldn't be there be another minus below that equals before we get to formula revenue available for distribution to districts?
To be exact, Chair Barnhart, Representative Davis, yeah, that would be...
Okay. Just wanted to clarify.
Yes.
And then the last question for me, do we have an idea at this stage? I'm looking here to see if we have a preliminary revenue or whatever the estimate's going to be called for this particular thing. Do we know what this is likely to cost, this change in dollars?
And we have PPS up.
We'll hear from David. Okay, fine.
And on top of Portland Public Schools, I have input from Eugene School District.
Okay.
So let me talk about Eugene first.
Please.
They have about to provide transportation to students, high school students actually, residing 1.5 miles, more than 1.5 miles from school. Actually, Eugene School District uses about $100,000.
$100,000, okay.
And reimbursed rate of 70% means $70,000. So they get reimbursed $70,000. On top of that, actually, Eugene School District distributes bus passes to some of the students who reside within 1.5 miles from school. That portion is not approved transportation cost. That's about $25,000.
All right, so it's not subject to this bill?
If this bill becomes the law, then that part becomes also approved transportation cost.
All right. Other questions? Let's go ahead and hear from David Williams, the only person who signed up. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill today? And you're here for Portland Public Schools.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. David Williams with Portland Public Schools. You have before you a bill at our request. Staff did a very excellent job of explaining what we're attempting to do here. And at the risk of putting some other baggage on the table, I do want to give a little bit of historical perspective on how this program has come about to where we are today and why we are coming to you as a partner in trying to accomplish this. So Portland, for a number of years, has had a waiver from the State Department of Ed from providing traditional yellow bus service to our high school students in the district. And we have provided transit passes to kids who live outside of the walk zones for our high schools and then submit that for reimbursement. And we do get the 70 cents. We are at the lowest reimbursement rate, the 70 cents on the dollar reimbursement. So we're expending for those kids about $1 million for those kids and getting $700,000 back from the transportation grant to pay for those. So $300,000 net out of the district. There was a program created a number of years ago that had a lot of other unintended consequences in it and has subsequently gone away. That was the Business Energy Tax Credit Program. Mm-hmm. Through that program, we were able to find good partners to expand the Transit Pass Youth Pass program to provide transit passes to all students in our high schools, whether they live inside or outside the walk zones. Of course, that program has subsequently disappeared. We've worked with the city and TriMet for a couple of years now to piece together funding to keep this going, but we all know the strains that all of our local governments are facing, and it was simply an unsustainable approach to continue to go year by year and piece that together. What is important in this historical perspective is, of course, the cost to simply run yellow buses for our high school students would be a rather significant burden on the state school fund if we were to begin that operation. And all of those would be eligible for reimbursement and that 70 cents on the dollar. So we are, by using a transit pass program, saving the state, by Portland and Eugene, saving the state significant money by using a much more efficient method to get our kids to and from schools. And the transit pass program, of course, I hope I don't need to talk about the value we're bringing to kids who are able to take advantage of not just the to and from school, but all of the other various activities that are available to them in Portland. And I know this is a fairly unique circumstance, given the geography of Portland, given our transit district and the way we operate. We also do have a lot more options in the form of some district-wide focus programs where students are able to leave their traditional high school and go to other places like Benson and other programs to take advantage of a variety of options. And the transit pass gives them effective and valuable means to get to and from those programs. And we think that there's high value here. The function of this would be that we would add as a reimbursable cost transit passes for those students that live inside of the mile and a half walk zone from their neighborhood high schools. This would add about $2 million in reimbursable expenditures to the transportation grant, of which we would receive 70%, so $1.4 million annually for those students. Of course, for the district, we would be increasing our individual costs as well, picking up the additional 30 cents on all of those dollars. You do have an amendment in OLIS as well that would limit the bill to school districts that have waivers as of, I believe, January 1 of this year, limiting it to Portland and Eugene. This was at the request of several of my labor partners, and that's just, I put that's on the table for you to consider as well. We think it's a great program. It's served kids well. We'd love to see it as a model to be able to be used in other areas of the state where they do have effective transit districts. I know that this conversation is happening in other committees, and we're hoping to engage in those as well. Funding around youth passes for kids all around the TriMet service area, in the Lane Transit District, in Chariots, et cetera. We think there's a great opportunity to take advantage of where we have robust transit systems to, you know, not have duplication of services, but really provide better and more effective services to kids, and that's really what you have before you today. The other thing that we may be able to consider, and it may be worthwhile, because I know that there are concerns about by simply moving money around in the formula, we bring this concern a lot when it comes to formula legislation, that we're watering down all of the rest of the money that is distributed statewide. We think there may be a role here to place an appropriation in the bill and send it to Ways and Means, where we would be more than happy to advocate for an additional appropriation to essentially buy this weight in the formula. As we often say, when people bring changes to the formula itself, you ought to buy those weights if they're weights you're adding to that formula, so that we can effectively pay that and defray the cost to all the other districts in the state. We want to be conscious of that as well. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Williams? Yes, Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. David, historically, for the kids that you offer that to within that mile and a half, hasn't there been some discussion about means testing it to some extent, doing it for free kids who qualify for free and reduced lunch, or am I remembering that wrong?
You know, I think there was conversation when the business energy tax credit funding went away. I think that was part of the conversations we had with the city and TriMet about what was an effective way to focus the program. I think we had some concerns about how that translates on the ground in distribution of passes and the financial ramification. It's not as significant enough of a limiter to defray the cost of trying to track who is and who isn't getting the TriMet Youth Pass. It's a much simpler mechanism. Logistically on the ground, the mechanism is when you get your student ID card, we have a little TriMet sticker that we stick on that card. It's a much simpler mechanism for us to do that rather than create some sort of tracking mechanism. Not to mention at the high school level, free and reduced price is not a highly reliable way of identifying students in poverty, because high school students, the value of free and reduced price lunch is getting a lunch, and high school student participation in lunch programs is notably low anyway. So you don't get a perfect proxy for poverty when you talk about free and reduced price lunch at the high school level.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how many kids, and just on numbers?
Great question. I don't have it in here, and I can find that out for you. I can get you the number of kids that live outside the walk zones as well as the kids inside the walk zones, and I'll provide that for you.
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
And how is there variation in the transit passes? If the pass was simply to school and back, is that less expensive than the broader pass?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, that was an issue that, again, it goes to how you implement a pass of that nature. Creating some sort of electronic timestamp or some such, I think, became a more of an administrative burden for TriMet. I would note that these passes are only good during the school year. It goes along the lines of we've had conversations about limiting them to school hours, limiting them to school days only, et cetera. Again, all of those were a much greater logistical hurdle to overcome. So limiting it to school, the months that school is in session, so it's a 10-month pass. The students don't have this over the summer unless they want to purchase their own. The cost of creating that type of system outweighed any benefit from it.
Yes, please. Yes.
Well, of course, that doesn't answer the question. The question is, how much is the rest of the school system paying for that, which has nothing to do with getting back and forth to school? I don't care about the logistics of what TriMet has to dig up to pay for it. I just want to know the difference in cost.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I guess I'm having a hard time quantifying it simply because the pass is sort of like if you were to just go to TriMet and get a monthly youth pass, there's a cost. There's no way for us to differentiate between times of day or not, so it's hard to quantify exactly what the cost would be, say, a two-ride every day versus a monthly pass. There's a negligible difference in that.
Yes, please.
So I'll run to the other side that you mentioned earlier, and that is the cost if you were using the yellow bus. What's the difference there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, we estimated the cost of running yellow buses to be somewhere in excess of $5 to $6 million. It has been a number of years since we have had yellow buses at the high school level. We would have to either expand contracted services or bring in house, which would mean a significant purchase of a bus fleet for the district, which we do not have, as well as obviously the ongoing operation, but it was in excess of $5 to $6 million.
My last question.
Yes, please.
So the kids that are within the mile and a half, as opposed to those that are outside, do we have those numbers?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative, on the number of actual kids, I can get that for you and supply that.
The question is the. Maybe a percentage. Are we talking half? Are we talking a third? What I'm trying to do is obvious. I just want to make sure that whatever's done here isn't unduly benefiting those who happen to be so fortunate as to live and take advantage of this system as opposed to everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I just want to make sure that those that are within the mile and a half aren't getting something that we don't give anybody else just because we have the system available.
Sure. Representative Barnhart, Representative Bentz. So as I mentioned, the current reimbursable for outside the walk zone is $1 million. The reimbursable for inside is $2 million. So you would be talking approximately two-thirds of the kids live inside of their walk zone. I think the difficulty in understanding where there is a benefit and where there is not is when you begin to expand that conversation to discuss the way you would operate a yellow bus system with inside PPS. And that extends both to who is and is not benefiting from this, as well as to what the cost of that system would look like. So there are a number of mechanisms that come into play when you talk about that. So if I'm running a yellow bus line to one of my schools, even for kids inside the walk zone, we can create a flag stop where the kid can get on the bus and I'm running the bus into the school for them anyway, as well as there are ways that I can get waivers from that based on high crash corridors in the district, et cetera. So, you know, think places like Columbia Boulevard or Powell Boulevard or others where kids having to cross some of those streets would allow me to pick them up and bring them at a reimbursable expense, even though they are technically inside of the walk zone. And that's where we get to the difficulty in me getting a really hard understanding of what the true cost of running the yellow bus service would be. So,
thank you.
Representative Smith-Warner and then Representative Johnson.
No, I was just going to propose what David did about the two one-ways versus a monthly pass cost as a way to get at that cost
Johnson.
Differential.
Mr. Williams, what was responsible for the historical decision going back whenever it was that Portland Public wouldn't offer the yellow bus service for, we're talking secondary students or simply high school? This is high school, correct?
Correct, simply high school students.
Why was that? Why has that never been on the table in the past? Prior to the Betsy, I guess.
Sure. Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, I believe that the decision obviously goes to the genesis of the transportation mandate in the state, which is, we can certainly find this, 15-plus years old now. And I think it goes to the fact that Portland has always had a fairly robust transit system inside its boundaries. So when the transportation mandate came online and required districts to provide transportation for students living a mile from elementary and a mile and a half from secondary schools, we bus all of those eligible kids that are at the elementary grades, but felt that we had a robust and viable transit district in PPS, and therefore applied for the waiver and received the waiver for providing transportation. The waiver is not in the reimbursement. The waiver is in the requirement to provide transportation for the kids living more than a mile and a half. And so that was the genesis, was that we always have had this transit district with which to provide busing for these students.
Please, yes.
So, but you do have the yellow buses for the elementary and middle school kids, correct?
Correct.
They're running those same routes where those high school kids likely live, correct?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, no, they would not be the same routes at all. Obviously, your bell times are different, and mm-hmm. you know when kids are coming and going from school is different, as well as the physical location of our buildings is very different. Portland has a footprint. I don't want to say it's unique. It may or may not be. We have relatively small elementary schools and what are growing into relatively larger high schools. Therefore, you have a much larger portion of individual elementary buildings around the district, so you're creating a differential mm-hmm. transit pattern around your elementaries than you are for your high schools, which are also clustered in certain high traffic areas. You know, Lincoln High School downtown, Wilson High School on Capitol Highway, Benson High School right on a TriMet, a MAX line, Madison High School on 82nd, you know, Cleveland on Powell. So you have these high transit areas where we're transporting kids to and from, which allowed us to partner with TriMet originally to create these transit lines that run by our schools, realizing the challenge that may exist in other areas where there is transit overlap in defining those lines that create those bus routes where it's easy for your transit district to align with where your high school properties actually are physically located.
Now, at the high school level, do you offer open enrollment? Are kids able to transfer and move as their space available in high schools within PPS?
So, Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, historically, choice has been a very core part of Portland Public Schools. Right now, our board is undergoing a fairly robust conversation around mm-hmm. what role choice plays at the high school level. Unwittingly, what choice allowed students to do is to vacate their neighborhood high schools, which of course creates a spiral for those schools where their declining enrollment allows you not to build program at that schools. So our board has made the choice to restrict choice around some areas where possible to try to restore enrollment and faith in those neighborhood schools. And we've actually seen really great success at places like Jefferson and Roosevelt, which are now getting back to approaching 1,000-kid high schools and even exceeding them and really building that community around those schools. Of course, the overlay of the federal No Child Left Behind law, which allows and requires transportation and transit out of schools not meeting adequate yearly progress, which is allowed for some schools.
Yeah, please, yeah.
Well, I appreciate the, I was going to say peculiarities, I won't use that word, but uniqueness of the academic offerings and how Portland is really kind of a unique district, I think, within the state of Oregon in how students and families do kind of navigate. We really don't have a situation where you have neighborhood elementary schools that feed into middle schools that then feed into a community high school. You don't have that kind of model, but again, that's a really different circumstance, and I think you find throughout most of the rest of the state. And because of that nature, I guess I would hope that you could look to your city partners and your travel partners or transit partners, i.e. TriMet and stuff, and try to find a solution there that meets the needs of this, I'll say it, peculiar school district, rather than try to apply a standard formula that works pretty well across the state and try to make it fit this different setup that obviously, you know, you have different needs, you have different circumstances that the rest of the state doesn't encounter, but it makes me nervous when we try to take a standard assessment or standard funding formula and then try to make it work for Portland. So,
Representative Leininger, please.
Thank you so much for being here today. I want to make sure I heard right. I think I heard you say, but please correct me if I got this wrong, that it's cheaper for you to, you know, there's a, it's net more cost effective for schools to use the existing bus framework and have students get passes to meet their transportation needs to and from schools than it would be to provide yellow buses, but you'd have to provide yellow buses otherwise, and you'd in fact be compensated from this funding formula at a higher amount than you're asking to be compensated at because you're doing the thing that is more cost efficient. So if we were to somehow reject this request, we would be rejecting efficiency in favor of greater expenditure to get done the same thing. Am I misunderstanding?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Leininger. If fairly accurate, yes. The cost of providing transit passes, to simplify, the cost of providing transit passes to every single high school kid in Portland is cheaper than the cost to provide traditional yellow bus services for only eligible students living outside of the walk zone. So this is, we think, a much more efficient. Now, at the risk of undermining my case, of course, we've been doing this way for a long time. We have not been running yellow bus service, and by rejecting this bill, it would simply limit the transit passes to those kids living outside of the walk zones. There really is this is not an insignificant policy decision, I will grant you that, but it is a much cheaper system than simply running the yellow buses for eligible kids.
May I have a follow-up?
Yeah, please, follow up, yes.
So the way I see it, if we were to reject this, we'd be essentially penalizing you for saving us money and getting greater bang for the buck through the innovative thing you're choosing to do, and therefore it seems like a reasonable ask to me. So thanks for explaining it.
Thank you. Representative Whitson.
Could you explain how the other school districts in the state are handling their high school students who live less than 1.5 miles?
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitson, you know, I would not want to speak for other school districts. Obviously, other school districts are using the model of providing yellow bus service for students that live outside the mile and a half distance from their neighborhood high school. And I think you've seen several changes to the transportation grant. Again, this is the transportation grant is not a sacrosanct thing, where we've tried in the past to address the needs of high-cost districts that have a much higher than average transit cost for their schools, hence the 80 and 90% reimbursement for the districts that have the highest cost, which is generally a proxy for they have the greatest distance to travel as well from their high school. When it comes to the inside, when you're running the bus, students have the sort of the right, the district can create an ability for the bus to stop on its way in and pick up kids that live inside of that walk zone currently. And that changes the reimbursement somewhat. And I don't want to, I don't know the level of detail on that, but that option does exist for districts. But, you know, I'll let other districts explain how they do it, but it's pretty much universally a traditional yellow bus service for every other high school in the state except for Portland and Eugene.
Okay. I think there's something else that we don't take into consideration, and that is the exercise that the kids get by walking to school, especially, I'm not talking about the little kids, but we have a real obesity problem, and I mean, I kind of have a hard time personally thinking that, and I've seen it happen, kid gets on a bus and three blocks later they're getting off from a bus, and I really don't understand that, and I know that's not your situation, but it certainly is something to think about the great
you.
Scheme of things.
Other questions? I have several. We've been alluding to it around the edges of things. I'm aware, because the University of Oregon is in my district, and I was on the Eugene School Board at the time that this original conversation took place in Eugene, which I think was before Portland did it, that when a transit district is considering what it would charge to provide these services, a whole lot of convenience issues for the transit district comes into play. I'd like you to sort of respond to this monologue for a second, because I don't know how to ask the question without sort of saying what I think the facts are. I think the facts are that it's a whole lot cheaper for the transit district if they can simply look at a student body card and provide service than if you have to buy passes and distribute them to students. Between your overhead cost and the transit district's overhead cost, the cost of the latter is significantly more than the extra students you're going to pick up along the way. I'm getting a head nod to that. So I think that's part of the reason why you're talking about doing this, isn't it?
Sure, and Mr. Chair, I think Lane Transit District is slightly different than TriMet, and I certainly would let them speak on this.
And I'm sorry they're not here, because I'd love to hear from them.
And I know they have a bill that is a direct appropriation to Lane Transit District to cover their costs down there. Uh-huh. For us, we operate it much as TriMet operates for very large employers in Portland.
Yes.
Again, it's the sticker model, where they're simply applying a sticker to an OHSU ID badge or a Nike ID badge, right, or a Portland Public School student ID. So when a student comes to register for class at the beginning of school and they get their student ID, we slap a sticker on every one of those badges. So there is a simplicity for us in operation to be able to know we're slapping a sticker on every single kid, rather than to filter it all through yet another list to figure out who is and who isn't getting a sticker.
Right. And okay, can you tell us what the cost of a monthly pass is versus what you actually pay TriMet for that sticker?
Yeah, I can get that for you, for sure.
I mean, because, look, part of the conversation we're having here, and I'm hearing this, I don't know if what people's motives are for asking the question, but if I were asking the same questions, part of what I'd be thinking about would be, is this a fair use of our money,
right,
as compared to students in other parts of the state who get on the yellow bus in the morning and they get on the yellow bus in the afternoon, and that's it. That's what they get. And we're talking about giving your students a good deal more. Why would we do that? Well, one of the reasons I can think why we might do that is that because of the administration, it's just a lot cheaper to do that than it is to try to restrict them. I don't know if that's true or not, but it would be nice to know.
Right, and I can get you that.
Now, I can tell you that when Eugene started their program, they gave a monthly pass to people on free and reduced lunch if they live more than a mile and a half from the school or more than a mile and a half from the Lane Transit District bus stop, which was the nearest bus stop to their house, because there were some parts of the district that were outside of that range. Students who wanted to ride the bus who were outside of 1.5 miles but who did not qualify for free and reduced lunch had to buy their own pass. Now, I think the restrictions that we've been talking about, the requirements that we're talking about, have gone into effect since that time, and that since that time, in fact, all of the Eugene School District high school and middle school students qualify for the pass outside the 1.5 miles. I'd sure like it if somebody from Eugene or somebody from the Lane Transit District were here to talk about that, because I don't know what I've just said is true. But, of course, the issues that you're talking about, I think, are very similar in that when the Lane Transit District provides transportation to a University of Oregon student because the student shows a student body card, student ID card from the University of Oregon, which is all they have to do now, they do it that way because it's vastly less expensive than it is to figure out some other method,
right,
of doing that.
Yeah.
So understanding those numbers and how they apply against the typical cost that we put in transportation would be useful. I think some committee members might feel a lot more comfortable if, when we're all done, they could end up saying, oh, well, we're putting less money into Portland than we do into other districts, even though the kids are getting more service there because of having the luck of living in a place,
right,
where the transit district is pretty robust.
Yeah.
That would be helpful, I think.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, we can get those numbers. And I do know that I spoke with the superintendent of the Eugene School District, and he was submitting a letter. He may not have got it in time, and I'll flag him and see if he can help you work through some of those questions.
But
as well,
that number, the thing I've just asked you for, would be really useful to have from Eugene as well.
Okay.
I mean, personally, I have no problem approving this kind of thing if it actually saves us money and gives your students some extra goodies that other people don't get just because they happen to live in the transit district. I mean, why would you penalize them and cost us more money by doing it some other way? It wouldn't make any sense. I don't have any idea what the rest of the committee thinks about that, but that would make a difference to me.
Okay.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Vance, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is there any benefit to these transit districts, Portland's or Eugene, Salem's, of having these folks? In other words, is there some way that they're willing to cut the district a deal?
They do now.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I think that that goes exactly to the question that the chair was asking. I do believe that the rate we, the monthly rate that we pay to TriMet is much cheaper, much, I don't know, it is cheaper than the sort of rack rate of a monthly youth pass. Let me find out those precise numbers and get them back to you.
Follow up.
Yes, please.
So, the reason for the reduced expense, why?
Why would it be cheaper? Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I think we've worked with TriMet really hard to understand some of the values and efficiencies, if you will, of a universal program where not every kid is using it to the same extent. So on average, probably giving a youth pass to every kid in the district, you're going to get an average use that is something less than the garden variety student who's buying a rack rate pass, because the student who's buying a rack rate pass is going to be a much heavier user of transit, whereas most of your kids will use it for something less than that, whether that be simply to and from school or maybe just to school in the morning and they're walking home on sunny days or some other variation, right? So we've worked very hard to help them understand that there is a lower usage rate than that standard usage, as well as the notion of creating a generation of students who are comfortable and competent as transit users, who will become transit users and transit purchasers as they stay and live in the Portland metropolitan area.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other Representative Johnson, please.
One thought, Mr. Chair, that just came to mind. I mean,
yeah.
We spent a fair amount of time yesterday debating a topic in this body, and I wonder if Portland Public wouldn't want to be the poster child for low-carbon fuel standard. If they would take it on their own initiative to buy a fleet of gas-powered buses, they would have credits descending from the sky that could enable them to add all sorts of FTE and everything else. So,
how about electric-powered buses?
Either way, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair, let them. Here we go.
Mr. Chair, Representative
it's all
Johnson,
for you.
I would note most of our busing for elementary grades is on a contracted service, and all of those buses are propane-powered.
Well, he's ahead of you.
They always are.
That's useful to know. Thank you. Yes, Representative Whitsitt, please.
What percentage of TriMet ridership are these students?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt. I can get that number for you. It's a low number as a percentage of total TriMet ridership. TriMet is a very large geographic boundary incorporating most of East Multnomah County as well as big parts of Washington and Clackamas County. We, Portland Public Schools, for those who may not be aware, is actually smaller than the city of Portland. We go from the western edge of the city of Portland only to Interstate 205, at which point there are four other single high school districts that touch the boundaries of Portland Public Schools, as well as one on the southwestern edge, Riverdale School District as well. So we do have some differences in that respect.
I have a
yes, please.
Follow-up. So does TriMet in any way count or depend on these transportation grant monies in any capacity when they're determining their budgets?
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, I couldn't speak to TriMet's reliance or not on this. I'm not familiar with the size of their budget. Again, what we're talking about here is the scope of about $3 million annually. I would expect that TriMet's budget is probably something in excess of $100 million a year. I don't know to what degree this impacts that.
I think staff can probably get those numbers for us pretty easily because those are public numbers, at least the magnitude of the numbers, at least. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2858 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2990. Chris, haven't seen you lately.
I have been traveling throughout the building.
Yes, you have.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2990 deals with corporate tax credits, and in particular, the issue of carry forwards. And just by way of context for the newer members,
less than 1%.
When companies are allowed to claim a tax credit,
they will claim that amount on their tax return, but if they do not have sufficient liability to use the full amount of the tax credits, they can be used in subsequent tax years. And the use of those tax credits in subsequent years are what are referred to as carry forwards. In OLIS, I have a document that is, it's just called meeting material. That is a table of all of the corporate tax credits. House Bill 2990 goes through about 29 of them and creates a uniform carry forward provision. Right now, the carry forwards range from no carry forward up to 15-year carry forward, with most of them being either a 3-year carry forward or a 5-year carry forward. The concept behind House Bill 2990 would place a 3-year carry forward for all of the tax credits. It would be a standard carry forward issue. The language, the way it's done here, might not be the best way to approach that, but that's getting into some of the technical issues. So conceptually, it's just a uniform provision. The handout that I have in OLIS, it's kind of broken down into two pieces. The first piece goes through the 29 tax credits and tries to provide a Dakota ring, if you will, between the ORS number and at least the name of the tax credit as per the tax expenditure report. So it at least gives you a flavor of what the policy is there. And then at the bottom, I did include, it's about 14 other tax credits that were not included in the bill. And most of those that were not included in the bill either had no carry forward or a 2 or 3 year carry forward, although there were some exceptions. Within each of these groups, you do have a mix of what I'll call active tax credits and tax credits that have already sunset. So looking at the bill, of those 29 credits, 18 of them are still active. Some of them are part of the review process this session, and some of them have sunset dates further into the future. And 11 of them are not active. They have already sunset in one form or another. For example, the first one there in ORS 315.104, the reforestation credit sunset. That was one that the legislature allowed to sunset during the 2011 session. And so the potential impact, and you will note that the tagline for the bill has a 3/5 vote on it. And if my interpretation of that is that if the sunsets were just applied to all of these, then you have a tax credit who has, say, a 5-year carry forward within, and this is really getting into the weeds of magnitude, so setting aside the issue of magnitude, if a credit has a 5-year carry forward, most of them do have some use over that entire 5-year period. So if the carry forward were limited to 3 years, the increase in revenue comes from losing the carry forward that would be used in years 4 and 5. Now, generally speaking, that magnitude isn't large, and I have not yet gone through the bill to find out what that magnitude would be. But that's my guess, if you will, as to why the 3/5 vote is okay. Is in the bill.
Well, I assume that a business that has tax credits available tends to use them as soon as they have tax liability to apply them against. Do you think that's true, or have I misunderstood that?
I would expect that to be the case, and for tax credits, it can be fairly complicated, I guess, for the corporations claiming the tax credits, because they'll want to use in any given year the oldest tax credits first.
First, right.
And
But they will use them to the extent of their tax liability.
Yes, they're required to.
Let me see if I can say this right. Whatever it is that they would otherwise owe, they will use that many tax credits if they have them available.
Presumably, yes.
Yeah.
Now, some of the tax credits, I think the veteran members here are aware of this credit usage percentage that floats, that I will talk about, and that's basically the amount of a tax credit that gets used compared to how much is claimed. And usually tax credits have a usage percentage of maybe 75%, somewhere in that neighborhood. Although one of the tax credits, the R&D credit, the Qualified Research Activities credit, has a usage rate of only 10%.
Wow.
So roughly on corporation terms, there might be $80 million claimed, but only $8 million is being used to offset tax credits.
So are you saying that 90% of them expire unused?
That's a good question.
Okay.
I think it kind of has to be that way. Now, the qualified research activity, it's those are the credits at the bottom of this first group, and they have a five-year carry forward. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The information that's reported on the tax returns, we don't have high-quality data to separate out the original claimants versus the carry-forward pieces. And this is a discussion that it's an ongoing discussion with the Department of Revenue, especially with the core systems replacement, about possibilities to weed all of that out. So we can say with a fair degree of certainty that in any given year, these are the amount of credits claimed for the first time, and then these are the amounts of carry-forward. And then even within that, just because more complication means more fun, a multi-year corporate tax credit can be a three-year credit, so that initially there's an initial first year, second year, and third year, and before you get into carry forwards.
Thank you. Other questions for staff? Representative Smith Warner, please.
Would you mind? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris, would you mind for those of us who are new on the committee to explain in whatever layman's terms there might be the difference between used and claimed?
I am a taxpayer, and this applies to individuals as well as corporations. Okay. I'm an individual, and my gross tax is $1,000. And that's gross tax is the amount of tax before any credits are used. Okay. And I am allowed to claim $1,200 in tax credits. Mm-hmm. So I have $1,000 gross tax, $1,200 in tax credits, and none of these credits are refundable, setting aside that issue. So my gross tax, I will use $1,000 of my tax credits to reduce my gross tax down to zero. Mm-hmm. I will then have $200 in credits that I can't use because I have reduced my tax down to zero. If I have if that credit has a carry forward, then I can take that $200 and save it, if you will, and use it on my tax return next year.
Okay, thank you. And may I have a quick
Please,
follow-up?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So you claimed $1,200, but you only used $1,000?
Mm-hmm. Correct. So
okay.
The usage percentage there would be 1,000 divided by 1,200.
Okay, and then one more quick
yep.
one.
Mm-hmm.
And in the example you used of you being an individual taxpayer, can individual taxpayers do this, or can only businesses do this?
It depends on the credit. It's a credit perspective.
So some credits for individuals and for businesses are carry forwardable, and some are not.
Well, and of course, some businesses don't have their own tax return. Their tax return is the one that the owner files.
Mm.
And so in that sense, it's the same.
Okay.
Yeah,
those the LLCs, the S-Corps.
Okay,
right.
Thank you.
Representative Leininger, and then Representative Woodson.
Thank you. So I want to make sure I understand this. It seems like the chart you gave us identifies currently the number of carry-forward years for a lot of tax credits being more than three.
Yes.
And so the thing that this legislation would do would be curtail the amount of carry-forward a holder of the credit can use, and therefore keep more money for the state because you couldn't avail yourself of as much value in tax credits because your period of availability shrinks down. And is that why it requires a 3/5 vote? And how much money is
Please. I haven't checked with Ledge Council on that, but that would be my take. Now, sometimes the 3/5 question, a lot of factors can play into that, and sometimes there's an order of magnitude that can play in.
Okay.
And I haven't given. I don't okay. know what that order of magnitude is.
May I ask a follow up? Because I'm still learning a lot on this. So I see that this is essentially a revenue raising measure, but it would also create more predictability about tax revenue foregone. And I know that, you know, with Betsy, for example, it seems like one of the things people really lament is that that the people who approved that didn't foresee how much tax revenue was going to be foregone And maybe by curtailing the usability period, it's easier to discern how much tax revenue is going to be foregone, which leads me to my question, which is, how much tax revenue is on the table here that the state would be collecting in your, you know, have you got any preliminary estimates? Are we looking at $100 million a year more to the general fund, less? Who knows?
Representative Leininger, I haven't done that. There are a number of policy questions that would come into play. The first cut at that would be the active credits versus those that have already sunsetted. Because I think those are different policy questions. If a tax credit has sunsetted, it can't be actively claimed almost everything. Depending on the date of the sunset, every piece of it would be a carry forward. And so the policy has already allowed, it's kind of a past issue, so to speak, for a tax credit that has sunsetted. Not that
right.
the legislature
right.
can't change it, because you can. But I think the discussion might be a little bit different. And then you have the active credits, those that are sunsetting this year or in future years. And so for some of those reasons, I haven't gone in and looked at the revenue piece of it, although I certainly can.
Thank you.
Representative Whitson.
So this list is really varied. I mean, it's all over the place. And so I'm just wondering, and help me if you will, like on livestock killed by wolves, most livestock, when you go to declare it on your taxes, if you've raised it yourself, it has no value until you sell it, typically. So is that a special thing that somebody put out for that? Because if I raise a foal or a calf, it has no value for tax purposes until I sell it, and then I pay capital gains tax, right, on that.
Depending.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm not a, you yep. know, okay. So there's all kinds of stuff here. I'm not understanding exactly. So are these government programs already that we've set aside and said you have this much to, you know, we've put something in statute or?
Yes.
Let me take a whack.
Okay.
Let me take
All
a
right.
whack at that. I happen to remember the one you referred to was one of Representative Jensen's favorite issues to deal with the problems that were occurring in his district with wolf depredation because of the reintroduction of wolves in eastern Oregon. And I think the answer to the question more generally is that tax credits are both an economic and a political device that's used by a variety of people for a variety of purposes. One of the reasons why we spend so much time on them and have since 2009, I think, actually 2009 when we passed the sunset bill originally, was to try to see if we could develop some rationality behind these things. But they do cover a wide variety of topics, a wide variety of needs, and they have a wide variety of qualifications of how you get the tax credit in the first place.
Okay.
So what we're talking about in this bill is simply one topic, and that is the limitation on how many years you can carry forward the tax credit before you either have to use it or it goes away. And that's all.
But if I may follow
yeah,
up,
please.
It just seems like it would be so variable looking at the list. I mean, mm-hmm. if we have something that goes to, you know, 2018 or, for example, pollution control, that's a hugely broad category.
Yes, it is.
I mean, I guess I would have to go in and look up the relevant statute on it to see exactly.
That one's gone.
But yeah. this just seems like to put a single number. Is that what we're looking at?
Yeah,
you know, on all of those things. When, mm-hmm. and I think Rep. Benz referred to it before. When you may need something at a certain time, when something wears out, maybe 5 years from now. Versus, you know, if you say it's only good for 3 years, you may not need that item until, if it's a piece of equipment or something, 5 years from now.
And I think that's one of the reasons why we hold hearings and and ask people to talk about these ideas.
I just want to make sure I'm understanding what we're looking at here. Just say, are we trying to put a single number on the whole list?
That's what the bill does. What the bill does is put a single number on the whole list, so that if you engage in an activity that leads to a tax credit in a given year, you would be able to file it on that year's tax return plus the next three.
Yeah.
That, I think that's, is that right? Or plus the next two?
The next.
Okay, yeah.
If a three-year carry forward is for the next 3 years.
Would be for the next three. So it would be four different years that you could claim it on until you'd used it all up. And, of course, that only applies to ones that haven't expired yet. The one you referred to specifically, pollution control, expired in 2007.
Yeah.
So it's past the use of, past the time when we're going to be concerned about it. No?
Mr. Chair, that is one where the credit is taken over 10 years, and then each of those years has a carry forward.
Has a piece. Okay.
Has a piece.
Okay. So, in other words, the last year you can take it would be 17 plus the carry forward, whatever that carry forward is. Yeah. And so each one of these things has different rules, and it's based on the particular nature of the tax credit itself.
Well, if I may follow up, it seems to me like if we did this, there was a reason that we did this and we put this in statute. To go back now and change all of these would be a real hardship for some of the companies and the people depending on this when they acted in good faith when this came through as part of the political process, and then all of a sudden we just take it away from them. I mean, just it seems to me really inequitable, basically.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Smith-Warner. I would just say I acknowledge, I understand where Rep. Whitsitt's coming from, and I think that while I'm not a tax attorney and I hope to never be one, I think, tax law changes. I mean, look at the federal law. Tax law changes regularly, and it's a part of doing business. And I think that you can make a pretty strong argument for kind of consistency of our budget planning of this idea of, okay, we understand that corporate tax expenditures have some value, have various value in policy that we are promoting through these, and at the same time we want to not. The way to make I think you can make a strong argument that by limiting the amount of time you can use and carry them forward, you increase our ability to do long-term planning and decrease the potential for more and more corporations using these credits down to zero, so that we and basically allowing for the concept yet trying to keep it from being misused or overused, and so I think the concept of a regular a standard amount of time for them is interesting. The other thing I would say about this particular one is I'd be interested to talk with you, Chris, about it seems a little odd to have the inconsistency of doing it of two-thirds of them and not the other third, so there's something to be said for that, but
that would be an offline conversation.
Yes.
I think at this point,
yes,
Representative
definitely.
Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris, I like your chart, but it needs a few more columns, and I know you have so little to do that you'll welcome this suggestion. Why don't we look at this contributions to the Office of Child Care? That looks like one of those corporate things that needs attention.
If I could, Representative Benson, I'm very conscious of the time. We have another bill to do. Would you mind taking this up with Chris offline?
Mr. Chair, just have one comment,
please,
I could.
Please.
And then, of course, I'll say no more until the next bill. There are like six more columns that need to be on here if a tax credit is to enjoy its purpose. And I'll only say that when we hear remarks like, we should just get all this in the general fund, it'll be better, it reminds me of the thought that they must do in Ways and Means when they apply the same types of standards, I am sure, to the type of expenditures that occur on that side of our building. So I'm just saying lots of discussion on this chart. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No, I completely agree with that comment.
I have one just really small question.
Yes.
That I don't know if I understand. Are we talking about tax credits going forward? Are we talking about retroactively limiting stuff that people have already, tax credits they've already built, like housing for farm workers around or whatever.
Representative Whitsitt, that was one of the, I made reference to technical issues. That's one of the things that's not clear in the bill right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you. Well, that will, right now, we don't have any witnesses on this bill. Is that correct?
Not when I came up here.
Okay. we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2990. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2334. And who's on that one? Christine? Okay. And we have at least one witness on that? Yeah. Mr. Kodish, would you come up while she does her explanation? Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill today? I don't see anyone. Christine, go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2334 would allow the payment of taxes, penalties, and interest found to be deficient to be made within 30 days after the taxpayer files a complaint to the tax court. Also would allow the taxpayer to file an affidavit alleging undue hardship within 30 days after receiving a notice of a lack of this affidavit from the court. Currently, the taxpayer would have to pay or file that affidavit along with their complaint to the tax court or lose their eligibility to do so. This measure would change that.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Yes. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Eric Kodesh, and I'm a partner at Stoll Reeves, specializing in tax. I'm here as a representative of the tax section of the Oregon State Bar in support of House Bill 2334. House Bill 2334 is primarily to fix a procedural issue for income tax disputes in the Oregon Tax Court. When a dispute involves a net income tax, the taxpayer does not have to pay the tax, penalty, and interest assessed by the Oregon Department of Revenue to contest the matter in the Magistrate Division. However, payment generally is required if the taxpayer wants to appeal to the regular division or skip the Magistrate Division and go straight to the regular division. There is an exception to this payment obligation if payment would be an undue hardship for the taxpayer. The 2013 decision by the regular division in Scott versus Department of Revenue highlighted what we think is an unintended timing problem with how a taxpayer asserts that payment would be an undue hardship. House Bill 2334, which modifies ORS 305.419, fixes the problem, allowing litigants a lower procedural bar to get to the meat of their claim. And essentially what the bill does is that currently ORS 305.419 requires that a taxpayer filing a complaint in the regular division for whom payment of the assessed tax, penalty, and interest would be an undue hardship must file an affidavit of undue hardship along with the complaint. Failure to do so, even if it's by accident, results in the case being dismissed. House Bill 2334 expands the deadline for this filing requirement for an undue hardship affidavit by giving taxpayers 30 days from being notified of the failure to file an undue hardship affidavit to correct the matter. If the taxpayer still doesn't meet that 30-day deadline, the judge will dismiss the case. But the important thing is that the modification to ORS 305.419 will provide modest means litigants with some procedural flexibility while still ensuring that the Department of Revenue maintain its ability to collect appropriate tax, penalty, and interest. And I'm happy to take any questions.
You. Questions? How many cases do we have like this?
So far, there's only been one that I'm aware of. But I think the bar looked at this and said, well, if it happened once, it could happen again. And it's happening to people who, by definition, you know, kind of the more modest means payment of the amount to contest the matter is an undue hardship.
And they're not represented primarily.
This taxpayer was, and the attorney actually, as part of the litigation of this procedural issue, had said that the attorney thought he had mailed the hardship affidavit and it just wasn't included in the document. So, I don't know if the attorney was representing on a pro bono basis or what the background of that was, but it was a person for whom, to be able to continue to dispute the matter and get it resolved in the Oregon Tax Court, the actual payment would have been in a hardship, and they wanted to continue to be able to first have the court determine that they actually owe the amount before the payment.
And forgive me, I'm not familiar with the way that the taxation section works. Is this an official position of the taxation section? And if so, how did it get there?
So this is, I believe, an official position of the Oregon State Bar, and it was brought to the bar itself has many different sections, and
yes.
The tax section is one of those. And when this case came out, Judge Breithaupt issued the decision on this, members of the tax section saw this as an issue. We worked with Judge Breithaupt and also the Department of Revenue to see if we could figure out a way to fix this. And so Judge Breithaupt has reviewed this, and the Department of Revenue confirmed that they can administer this law.
Thank you. I'll note, colleagues, that this came from the Committee on Judiciary by unanimous vote.
Right.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Does the department want to be heard? If there are questions for the department. All right. Okay. Anybody have questions for the department? We don't. Thank you very much. I appreciate you waiting this whole long meeting for your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2334. Committee, we'll see you on
Monday.
And we're going to have another exciting meeting. With that, the committee is adjourned.